Okay. So our next session is Hans, Sue, and Yale to cover off for us the board and IFRS Foundation activities since our last meeting. So, Hans, I'll hand over to you.
Yes. Thank you, Joanna. I would like to start with giving a progress report on the insurance standard. We have a lot of people working very hard to get the standard finished. At this moment, the staff is making the final edits to the standard and to the effect analysis. Some parts of the work has already gone into production, and we are set to go in May, and all the signs are on green in a sense that we expect to indeed publish the standard in May. Of course, this will be a huge change for everybody, knowing that IFRS 4 basically grandfathers a highly diverse and fragmented basket of national insurance standards, so everybody will need to adapt. And not only is the current set of national insurance standards very diverse, many of these standards are also rather outdated because we have taken simply too long working on this standard. So the insurance world is grappling with a deficient set of accounting standards, and all the issues that there are in insurance accounting are not caused by the industry itself, but basically by the poor standards that they often have to work with. In the effect analysis, we will give an overview of the improvements that the new standard will make. And I would just like to highlight a couple of them because the standard will be issued well before the next meeting of this group. And I thought it would be good to give you a brief overview of some of the most important improvements that we will make. First of all, the fact that the new standard will make consistent use of current estimates of the insurance liability. At this moment, a lot of national insurance standards do not fully update the insurance liability. A lot of them work with historical cost, and that means that estimates are not fully updated after inception. Often it only takes place when contracts are deemed to be onerous. And then there are also, under IFRS 4, there are no clear rules for the onerous assessment, for the assessment when a contract is onerous. And that means that it is not clear that there is a timely recognition of onerous assessment, of onerous contracts. And definitely, our standard will give much clearer guidelines on that, and should result in more timely recognition of contracts that have become onerous or that have been onerous from the very beginning. Also, currently, when the liability is measured, there is not a consistent use of the discount rate, which is based on characteristic of the liability. Some standards prescribe asset-based interest rates, and others use regulatory rates. In our standard, it will be consistent use of discount rates based on the characteristics of the liability. Then also, in some national gaps, embedded financial options and guarantees, they don't get updated on a regular basis. Often they are only recognized when they are in the money, when they are really starting to bite. And obviously, investors would like to see, would like to have insight in the development of these guarantees and options even before that. In our standard, there will be current valuation of options and guarantees. We also believe that our standard will provide better insight in the profitability of insurers. Most gaps do not really have clear rules for aggregation of insurance contracts, We still have huge discussions about the level of aggregation with some insurers. Sometimes I call it the level of aggravation. But the result of current practices is that some contract portfolios that are less profitable can be offset by profits in other contract portfolios, and that can lead to the standard not providing a clear picture of financial performance. And then there will also be consistent rules for profit recognition in the insurance industry. Currently, in some GAAPs, for example, in UK GAAP, there can be upfront recognition of profits. For example, when an insurance has closed a contract on annuities, the expected profits, because they are obviously expected profits, these annuities can take 20, 30 years, are recognized upfront. In other jurisdictions, the profits are only recognized when contracts are terminated. So huge variety in profit recognition. And then two final points. Currently, there are no consistent rules for revenue recognition. Most insurers present premiums received as revenue on a cash basis, and in some jurisdictions, it is even possible to recognize deposits as revenue when these deposits are delivered for asset management schemes, something that is obviously very foreign to other sectors of the economy, such as the banking and asset management industry. So in the new standard, there will be comparable revenue recognition rules or principles. And then finally, because there is such a wide variety of national insurance standards, IFRS 4 had no choice but to allow insurers to depart from the general requirement to apply uniform accounting policies for similar transactions. Multinational insurance companies now are often forced to consolidate numbers that have been recognized in different ways according to different national insurance standards. Some of which are totally incongruent. So actually the consolidated numbers can be not shaky, but they do not rest on consistent policies. So all in all, we believe that the new standard should lead to a vast improvement in insight in profitability and the financial position of the insurance industry. And we also think, related to the previous discussion, that this should lead to, in the long term, to more financial stability in the industry. And in the course of this project, you know, we've talked also with a lot of investors, and some of them tell us it is too, given this fragmentation of national standards, the industry is difficult for us to understand, and that is one of the reasons why some investors stay away from the industry. So we also believe that the standards should lead to improvement of the investability of the insurance industry. Obviously, it's a lot of change, understandably, a lot of people in the insurance industry are concerned about the change, about the costs. One promising development was that some of our board members paid a visit to Korea last week. Korea is one of the countries where the insurance industry has huge legacy problems from the past, when interest rates were very high and a lot of guarantees were provided, which now are really biting. Our people were told in advance that they would be better for them to go in bulletproof vests, but they really had a very good reception in Korea. Most people seemed very eager to get on with the new standard. and to see it as an opportunity for systems change and for better management of their industry. So that was truly a very encouraging experience for our staff and board members that went there. Given the enormity of the change, it will be a complete overhaul for almost all insurers. And we are getting prepared for a big education challenge, not only to the industry, but also to investors. And also, during the project, we have completed field tests for all sections of the standard. But obviously, the real proof of the pudding is going to be in the eating. You can see that now with the implementation of IFRS 9, only now when the banks are starting to implement the standards, they can get a full grip on what are the effects going to be on my balance sheet, what do I do need to do in terms of changes of our systems. These are all things that are very hard to predict in advance. So during the process of implementation, a lot more insight will be given. We understand that, given the fact that this is going to be such a huge undertaking, we have already decided and published the fact that we're going to have a transition resource group, we haven't thought about a specific data, but I don't think we will wait too long after the publication of the standard. Transition resource group worked very well in terms of the revenue recognition project. Undoubtedly, unexpected items will come up during the process. I think when you look back on the revenue recognition project, we have stood ready to even make minor changes to the standard if necessary. Of course, we hope that that will not be necessary for the insurance standard, but we will have this TRG for a purpose, for the preparers to be able to bring issues to the table, and we will stand ready to deal with them when necessary. This is insurance. Have I taken up too much time already? Because I can...
Well, keep going.
Yeah? Last week we published the Principles of Disclosure discussion paper. In this paper we discussed high-level principles of effective communication, 7 principles of effective communication which could be included in a general disclosure standard or described in non-mandatory guidance. So that's what's going to be one of the questions to you all. Would it be wise for us to write a new disclosure standard, or can we do with just providing non-mandatory guidance? We also describe some possible approaches to improve disclosure objectives and requirements in IFRS standards, and we have looked at principles of fair presentation and disclosure of performance measures and non-IFRS information in financial statements. Well, this is obviously something that we are also going to look at in our performance reporting project, in the primary financial statements project. My sense is that this disclosure principles of disclosure discussion paper, that it might be a precursor of a general disclosure standard, but that really depends on the feedback that we receive from our constituents. And you will get an update later during this session of the Advisory Council by Michelle Fisher, who has been the main author of the paper. Upcoming is the materiality practice statement, which is being finalized. And we have had our first discussions on primary financial statements, in which we have discussed a couple of difficult issues. In the last board meeting, we basically decided that it would be wise for us to give it a try to define EBIT, It's a very commonly used performance indicator, which is very close to operating income, and it could be a very important anchor for reconciliation also of other non-GAAP measures, which are close to EBIT, but not quite there. And you would say, well, defining EBIT, that should be simple. You start with earnings, and then you deduct interest and taxation, and you're there. But unfortunately, nothing is simple in our world. What is interest? Well, that depends on the capital structure of a company, and so we first have to define what a capital structure is, so wish us luck. We are also thinking about doing some work on operating income, and one idea that we have discussed, also not so easy to do, would be that to say, well, if a company has one central performance indicator, which or performance measurement, which it puts in its investor package, but not in the financial statements because it's full of adjustments. What we could ask these companies to do is bring it into the financial statements, and bring with it the discipline of the financial statements, which is that it should be reconciled to, for example, that newly defined EBIT. It would involve audit if it becomes part of the financial statement. And we could also think about giving some guidance as to how to present unusual items, which are often the adjustments made to these two to EBIT, unusual items in terms of magnitude or frequency. Also, not very easy to do all of this, but I think it's a promising road to take for us. And then finally, and here I'm really looking forward to what you are going to say to us in the next 2 days, what should we do around wider corporate reporting? Difficult issue. It is getting increasingly relevant. It often includes financial information, and the question is, should we have a clearer place at the table than we currently have? I have ideas about that, but I don't want to prejudge you, and I'm really looking forward to what you are going to have to say about this subject later today and tomorrow. That's it for my part.
Any queries or comments of Hans also on that paper and or the technical agenda paper 1A, I think it is, that is attached to that paper before we ask Yale to comment on the foundation? Linda.
There was one comment that on the enormity of the change in the systems and processes with respect to the insurance contract, and I see that 2021 is still the date to be effective. I still have major concerns on that. As a SEC filer, our first balance sheet will be January 1st, 2019. The systems, the processes, the change to put that in, to be able to explain it to our investors, I do not think is going to do the standard justice. So I would like beg to see if we can defer that for a year. As you mentioned, nothing is easy in our world. A year ago, I would have told you that we are fair value today. We're current. We put everything through our P&L. I would have told you that I would have thought for insurance standards, we would have gone fair value. But because of things like non-GAAP measures and being able to explain things, it's quite apparent to us now that we're probably going to have to consider OCI. The reason for that is to be able to get a spread income, which we cannot get through fair value, to explain to our investors.
So to get what?
Spread. The difference between, instead of your fair, you're going to get your fair value noise with your spread noise. And as a result of that, we are now thinking that to explain the information to the investors, we are probably going to have to go OCI, which is even more complex and is going to be confusing on the face of it, but it'll actually help us to be able to explain it underlying, and that's what we're thinking through. So with all of these issues, and then the downstream impacts on both regulatory tax, as well as our subsidiaries worldwide, where we may have different underlying approaches, and then versus consolidation. 2021 is what we think is completely unrealistic, and we are an SEC filer with 3 years. We can't get away from it.
Hans, do you want to make a comment on that or absorb the information? Yeah, so we'll perhaps take other questions and comments and go from there. Olav?
No, I think would emphasise the IFRS 17 will indeed be a very, very significant exercise, and having to do restatements of previous years definitely creates challenges. Although I think in Europe we're not faced with a 3-year challenge, as just indicated. I think I would also highlight that it has been, of course, a very long and challenging journey for all of us in order to get where we are today, which is obviously close to the end of the process. I think we appreciate the extra work that's been done in recent last few years, with the extra time that's been given and used very, very productively, in mostly to achieve a much better standard than would have been the case. And even a lot of work has been done in the last months. I think there is still some small steps still to go in terms of the final wording, as I think was mentioned, and we look forward to cooperating and working hard on getting to a final solution as soon as possible.
Joanna, can I just add that I know that 2021 is to align IFRS 9 and 17. That becomes less of an issue once you know how you're going to manage your assets or account for your liabilities. So the 1 or 2 year difference is not an issue, because by then we will know what we're going to do with the assets.
Okay, just before Hans responds, Lothar, comments from you?
Yeah, much less controversial. I would just like to encourage what you said, Hans, on the non-GAAP measures, the approach, how I understood it, to get some discipline into that, maybe even put it into the primary statements. But not trying to define everything, because the non-GAAP world is a flexible world. So I think many users will be very thankful if you continue in that way.
Okay, well, Lothar, thank you for your comments. I don't really need to respond to that. Linda... about the effective date, of course, this has been a long process full of procrastination. 3.5 years should be enough. And I'm not so sure if the industry would be helped by yet another year. These difficult processes, the longer you take for them, I'm not sure if it will help you all that much. The use of OCI, I'm surprised to hear that. This is the first time I hear that in Canada that would be considered. I think the additional complexity of OCI is very high and will give you also a lot of challenges in terms of explaining to the investor what it is. And I'm certainly sure that this is one of the areas of OCI which contains most meaningful information. And I'm not so sure if it is a lot of investors stop thinking when they see things in OCI, and that's probably not what you want to achieve. So that would be a huge educational effort. I know that Insurance Europe still has some issues. I've seen a letter that was sent to EFRAG. We are always open to talk, and I think one of the issues that was raised will be already be clarified in the final text of the standard, which you probably have not seen yet. So hopefully these small issues will become even smaller.
Can I just comment on the comparatives? You're right that we require restatement of comparatives for IFRS 17, but we have said specifically that we only require 1 year of comparatives to be provided. And I know there are SEC requirements, but we had a precedent because the same issue came up with IFRS 10. And in that case, we specified that only 1 year of comparatives was required. And my understanding anecdotally was that did assist for US filers.
Mary?
Just to one clarification on what you said, we required only 1 year to be restated for comparative purposes rather than trying to override and waive the number of periods required to be presented.
Okay. If there are no further questions on Hans's report and the technical report, and Linda, I'm sure you can and will talk to Hans some more yourself. However, I will now ask Yael to report on the foundation, and I think that's paper 1B.
Yes, thank you, Joanna. This is the third work plan that I'm sharing with the Council. You will recall that we have articulated our 3-year strategy in 2015 around 4 strategic objectives. And in the last 3 years, we have been developing work plans that derive from these objectives and clearly articulate what actions are taken by the Foundation to progress towards achieving on each of our objectives. So many of the topics and actions that you see in this paper, particularly I'm referring to Appendix B, Appendix 1 of the paper, will be familiar to you because some of them are products and decisions that we agreed on collectively together with you as well throughout the processes of the review of structure and effectiveness and the agenda consultation. So what you have in front of you is a consolidated plan of technical and non-technical work that we plan for this year and gives you a full picture of what we want to achieve on each of the objectives. One word on the success metrics. You've all been part of our deliberations on what should be success metrics for the Foundation, and we discussed your input with the board and the Board Away Day last year, and a lot of your recommendations came into this paper. I think it's a much better set of metrics that we presented in the last 2 years, but there's still room for improvements. But just as one really important input that is a direct result of the Council's advice is if you look at what we say on IFRS's high quality standards, you will recall that I've asked a particular question on how do you think we should measure high quality, and the bottom line of the discussion in this group has led us to say that the one thing we need to measure here is reputation, and that idea developed into what Richard presented this morning. So thanks to the Council for that. It was a very good input. And indeed, we think that the best and most it's indirect because high quality is such an abstract concept, but the best way to assess it is by assessing what people think about the Foundation and whether it does deliver high-quality work. So this is really a direct contribution that you have. I'll go through the main parts as I see them in the work plan, and I'm happy to take questions afterwards. I'm not going to cover everything. It's a lot of detail. But if you look at the first objective, the high-quality standards, here you see, of course, the main highlights of the work plan, and Hans covered them. I want to point you to the point about maintaining relevance on both these fronts, the digital front and the wider corporate reporting fronts. We can show some progress in that. First of all, earlier this year, the SEC has recognized the IFRS taxonomy as valid for reporting. So at the moment, it's voluntary, but we understand that in the future, in about a year, it's going to become mandatory. So that's a good indicator for the maturity of the taxonomy, although still a lot of work, as you can see, is planned to even progress and improve our taxonomy. You will have a deep discussion on what we're planning to do on the other part, the wider corporate reporting. If you look at supporting IFRS implementation, I want to point to two important MOUs that we're working on. One, Rudy, that will interest you because of the comments you mentioned, raised with Sven this morning. We are negotiating with the Basel Committee, and Xavier here is involved, on an MOU that will enable us to better coordinate our work with prudential regulators. And we hope that, and the milestone, of course, here is to conclude the MOU. Of course, we've been working with the Basel Committee intensively, but this formalizes and further progresses our relationship. And equally, we have a very important work with the World Bank, and Pam here is also one of our champions of this work. So you see, we've been utilizing the members of this council very, very effectively to promote our initiatives with your respective organizations. So again, a very important step forward for us. Our relationship with the World Bank is extremely important, particularly in the developing world, and we want to build on what we achieved together, but also take it further to a further step, looking at more scalable cooperation that is based mainly on online and digital tools. And this is a very exciting development for us, I think, and for the World Bank, if I judge from the Friday discussion that we have had on this. On the third objective, which is our marketing and sales side of things, how we sell and make the standards adopted around the world. So here we have developed for the first time this year a very structured international strategy that clearly sets internally what are our sets of priorities for the next 2 years. And the idea of it is that sometimes we've been working sporadically and with ad hoc decisions, and we wanted to structure those decisions better and to make sure that we identify what are the key opportunities around I4S progress that we identify in the world, and how we tackle them to get the best and most effective results. So we have defined three categories, which is the international jurisdictions with which we work on a normal basis, the enhanced jurisdictions, and then focused jurisdictions that we focus on with particular plans because we identify, for example, an opportunity for I4S adoption in the near future. We continue our work on brand protection. Our main objective for this year, and I hope we can achieve it, is an IP agreement with India. And then if we move to our fourth objectives, which deals mainly with our own structure, our own operation, I want to point out on a very important progress with non-funding jurisdictions. So India is no longer in that category, having reached an agreement with the MCA, with the Ministry of Corporate Affairs, and we're very grateful for that very important progress. And I'm looking at Suresh because I'm sure he will deliver the word at home. And you will hear from Rick Russell, our newly appointed business development director. He will be here to explain to you how we deal with our IP, what are our principles. We're trying to be very equitable here. I know a couple of you in the past raised with me the concern about how we commercialize our assets and whether there's a clear and thorough thinking around that, and we want you to be familiar with that. Obviously, this is a very important area for us because our public funding structure is not yet complete. We do not have all countries that use I4S participating in the budget, and we continue to work with them on a voluntary goodwill basis, but our activities and our needs go beyond what we can achieve from these voluntary contributions, so we must work on our self-generated income that is basically the basis for our sustainability in the future. So this is a very important and sensitive area of work that you will be familiar with later today. In the governance and oversight sides, obviously, I've presented in last year our analysis of the Brexit risks. We've asked Callum to give you some more details on that, so I won't spend time on it, but the big important decision that was made by the trustees in January, as you saw from the meeting summary of the trustees, is that for the time being we're looking for a location in London. And I think the last bit I want to mention is that we are very proud in the area of the staff development that we renewed our accreditation as Investors in People organization. And I mentioned that because our staff is the most important staff, asset that we have. So this is a very important accreditation. We do that every three years. It's based on a very thorough analysis of how staff morale and attitude towards the workplace is, and we're very happy with the accreditation. However, we did identify a couple of topics that we need to work on to improve, and we will take that as part of the work plan. So with that, I'm open to any questions you may have.
Before I open it for questions, I personally would like to congratulate Yale, because I think about when I first sat here, which I think was probably 4 years ago, and the development of the strategic plan and the work plan for the year has just gone forward in leaps and bounds. And the areas that Yale has, and I say Yale, I know it is the trustees' work plan, but it's Yale has driven it with help from others, and I would suggest probably some resistance from others as well through the process. And that I look at this, and I can sit as a director of a number of companies, and I can say that I think that this work plan absolutely sits up there with the best of work plans and with the measures, acknowledgement that, yes, there can be some measures. And I think that it really shows tremendous progress for the foundation. And in fact, yesterday at the induction session, I made the comment in terms of that for new members that the foundation has moved way beyond what it used to be, and I'm sorry, Hans, just writing high quality financial reporting standards and saying, here you are, take them. There is an awful lot more to that, and I'm looking at Henry there around the implementation and all of those aspects of that and ensuring that we get the buy-in. And I think Yale has been, I think that's probably enough pats on the back for Yale, but I would like to congratulate her.
I thought you were going to say that we also write low-quality standards.
No, I wouldn't go that far, Hans. But, however, having said that, and I think you're right, the Advisory Council has helped with that. However, all the credit, you know, most of the credit is Yale's driving it. So, having said all that, further comments from the Advisory Council. Gas.
Going back to the old days when we still had the IAC, if I remember correctly, one of the criticisms of the IAC was that there was no enforcement mechanism. And again, with the ISB, there is still again no enforcement mechanism. But I still think that there are areas of concern in relation to that. Because over the years, the one thing that I discovered was that when countries implemented IFRS, they often interpreted IFRS in light of current standards. And so how IFRS has been interpreted in various countries hasn't always been exactly the same. And so that is obviously a concern. And so I would have thought that is an issue that should have been considered in the plan, and I can't recall why it hasn't. But also in that regard, the one area I would have also expected is that when local regulators or standard-setting bodies are issuing interpretations of IFRS, that the ISB should be endeavouring to obtain information of that and should be interacting with those bodies. But I didn't see anything in that, but maybe there's a reason why something like that hasn't been included in the strategic plan.
Yale, do you want to respond to that?
I think you're pointing to a very important point that is included in the plan, and if you look at the objective to support IFRS implementation, one of the most important things we're working on is number three there, support others involved in application of IFRS standards. And the first point is exactly the point about our work with regulators. So our work with the IOSCO Financial Reporting Group and the insurance regulators. and we are developing these MOUs. So we already signed an MOU with IOSCO and ESMA, and we renewed those MOUs, as you can see, in 2016. And what we're trying to do this year is getting some more feedback from them on improving that work. And maybe I can point to Henry, and Henry wants to add, he leads that work, and also we have a huge effort in also engaging the national standard setters. So maybe...
Sorry, that was just the other point, Yael, to add to that. I mean, obviously, our relationship with the regulators is very important, and that's how we get to... it's a two-way relationship, because we can use that to explain our thinking often behind the new standards to help improve and support consistent application of the standards. And obviously, the regulators can inform us about issues that we might need to address either through the Interpretations Committee or directly through the board. But the other area that we're doing a lot of work to develop relationships, again, with an eye on improving the general quality of implementation of IFRS around the world, is with the national standard setters, because, as you're alluding to, they have a key role to play in this. And we've been talking about our relationship and how they can work with us, how we can support them. And we actually talked about this at a recent forum of those standard setters in Taiwan, and Sue was there. And one of the things that we have with them is a protocol. So effectively, if there is any local guidance being issued, I mean, we encourage them to share it with us as well. But that guidance can take various different forms. And, you know, one of the things that I think national standard setters can do is sometimes produce, you might say, educational material that can help. And we're very happy and do look at that before it gets sort of published in the particular country.
So, Garth, I think, you know, you've obviously got a good point there, and the response is there. And maybe I might suggest that Garth, you and Henry have a little bit more of a conversation around this to see if there's anything further that Garth could add in terms of what might be done in this, as we all acknowledge, I think, a very important area. Now, my eyesight is appalling, and it's either Roxana or Susan who has put up their flag, and I think it says Roxana.
Thank you, Jenny. So having the insight, I certainly confirm that there is a lot of dialogue between the ISB and at least with ESMA via the protocol. But probably I understand Gerard's concern, because it's not quite well reflected in this here. And I think certainly we are a source of very useful information about the application. We certainly have intensified the dialogue through the revised protocol. But I don't think that is well reflected in here. And that's why I understand Gerard's reaction. Now, on the point of cooperation with the National Standard Setter, I think we have a separate discussion tomorrow about this, so probably I'm not commenting on that. Maybe the last comment I would like to make is in relation to enhancing visibility of interpretation activities. I think from our side, we were probably raising a bit the expectation towards the Interpretation Committee, because we believe it's very important for that committee to operate rightly. Otherwise, it's the first source of divergence in the application. And probably there is also useful to think about how the discussion in the Interpretation Committee can afterwards be turned in useful tools for education purposes.
I think that subject is on the agenda tomorrow, Roxana, or would you like Sue to make a comment now, or should we just make sure we cover it off tomorrow?
Fine, if we can cover it tomorrow, it's okay.
Yep, we'll make sure we deal with that tomorrow. Any further comments or questions around that strategic plan? Okay, what we might now do is that we have... Sorry, was there someone who... Oh.
And so we will have Ben now present the new website in private. Yeah, so.
Yeah, so I was going to say, Yael wants to comment on her own report.
No, I just want to say on a personal note that it's been a privilege to work with this group. I often found your contributions very surprising, and helpful, so points that I haven't thought about. And we try to be a very good link, me and Richard, as well as David before him, between what you say to us and then what we bring to the trustees. And I want to thank Joanna and Ada. I think we've changed the operation of the advisory council to fit the changing circumstances, and I think you led a very, very helpful
change. It wasn't agreed beforehand, the mutual patting on the back, by
yeah,
the way.
No, I think, you know, the council was very technical and hardly involved in the strategic work, and I think it's changed dramatically because of your interest and because of the needs of the organization. So it was really a productive process, and I thank each and every one of you, not only for your substantive contributions in the meeting. I've always used these occasions to push things in outside the table, so thank you all for your support in and out of the table.
Thanks, Yael. Yep, as Ida says, what we're now going to do is have a form of introduction to us around the new website. However, that session is going to be held in private because it has not yet been released to the public. So I am going to ask our observers, please, if they could leave us and be welcome back when we start again after lunch at 1:45.